From Texas Public Radio, this is Texas Matters, a weekly radio news magazine that looks at the issues, events, and people in the Lone Star State. Today on Texas Matters, a remembrance of the holidays. This is Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio. I'm Yvette Benavides. The holidays are a time of stories. There's the divine story of the birth of Jesus and the almost infinite volume of personal stories from each of our families. We at Texas Matters are pausing to listen to those stories, and we encourage you to tell your stories to your loved ones. I'd like to read a story my mother wrote about a Christmas she had in Laredo many years ago. A Christmas to Remember by Luisa Benavides. During my childhood in Laredo, Texas in 1947, my family consisted of my elderly grandfather, my mother, who had become a single mom 2 years earlier when my father left us, and my seven siblings. We were three girls and five boys in ages ranging from 14 years to 2 years. I was the fifth child and was 7 years old that year. Since we lived with my grandfather, we didn't worry about rent. However, I recall my mother worrying about money for food and the utility bills. Each early December, my mother made sure to tell us that Santa had money problems because of the war, so that we might not expect the many items we asked for in our letters to him. Because of her strong Catholic faith, she emphasized the real meaning of the holiday. That year was no different. My mother reminded us again gently of the real reason for the season as we put up our Christmas tree, which was actually a salt cedar branch with homemade decorations and no lights. My mother desperately tried to save a few dollars so that her children would have some semblance of a Merry Christmas. The older children helped our mother with her plan. My sister Yola, the oldest of us eight children, at 14 years of age, wrote 16 as her age on the employment application and started working at a store called Neisner's, one of four large 5- and 10-cent stores on Convent Avenue in downtown Laredo. To save money, Yola took a homemade sandwich for her lunch break, or my mother would send her a home-cooked meal with one of the older kids. On Saturdays, my 10-year-old sister Chayo and I would volunteer to take the meal. Chayo was familiar with the streets to and from downtown. We were excited to take that stroll, especially during the Christmas season. This mid-December, the stores were already in full bloom, with Christmas decorations, beautiful music, and enticing sales. On that Saturday, a few days before Christmas, Chayo and I quickly made the lunch delivery to Yola at work and then walked up and down the aisles of not only Neisner's, but those of Cress's, Woolworth's, and McClellan's, the other large stores on Convent Avenue. After roaming the aisles of the other stores, we went back to Neisner's for one last look. It was hard for the smaller kids to get close to see and touch the toys. I was pushed aside by people trying to get closer to the counter. Suddenly, I felt someone next to me down at my ear level. She whispered to me in Spanish, ¿Cuál te gusta, chiquita? Which one do you like, little one? I looked up and saw a tall, beautiful older woman smiling at me. She was dressed impeccably in an expensive-looking black dress. Without speaking, I timidly pointed to a red play iron. She immediately told the clerk to wrap it up before turning back to me to ask, ¿Cuál otro te gusta, mi cielo? I couldn't believe my ears. She asked me to select another toy. I was totally perplexed and worried as my mother's warnings about accepting stuff from strangers came to my head like a splash of cold water. But I set that aside long enough to timidly answer that I also liked the 20-piece dish set. I turned to look at my sister, who stood behind me nodding approvingly. The beautiful lady picked up the dish set and gave it to the clerk to wrap. But incredibly, she also included a beautiful baby doll, a doll's dress, and a laundry set of a play washtub and clothesline with several colorful clothespins. Waiting for the large, heavy bundle of goodies felt like an eternity. While we waited patiently but eagerly, the lady bent down to whisper in my ear again. She softly recited a short prayer and asked me to repeat it. I did, and I have remembered and recited it daily ever since. Niñito Jesús, amor mío, dame tu corazón y toma el mío. roughly translated as, "Beloved baby Jesus, give me your heart and take mine in return." The lady patted my head as she handed me the bag with all my treasures and with a big smile said, "Feliz Navidad, chiquita. Que Dios te bendiga." Merry Christmas, little one. May God bless you. Later, I couldn't recall if I had even thanked her. I became sick with worry about what my mother's reaction would be. When we got home, my sister explained the whole thing to my mother. I was relieved when my mom looked over at me and told me I could keep the toys. However, I noticed there was a sad look on my mother's face when she saw the beautiful doll, the iron, and the 20-piece dish set. Seeing her sadness made me sad, too. A few days later, on Christmas Day, Santa brought me a tiny play iron, a little rag doll, and a 12-piece dish set. The quality couldn't compare to the lady's expensive gifts. But to a 7-year-old who knew Santa's financial problems because of the war, his gifts were even more precious. My mom smiled as she saw me playing with my Christmas toys. Through the years, I have thought of the elegant woman in black as an angel sent by God to give a poor little 7-year-old girl incredible happiness at a difficult time, and left her a beautiful prayer to recite for the rest of her life.
In recent years, the name and stories of John Henry Falk have faded from our collective memory, like an old chipped Christmas ornament that no longer makes it onto the tree. When I ask many of my contemporaries and younger generation if they know the name John Henry Falk, most times I get a no. So let's dust off this Texas treasure and get reacquainted with his sparkle and humorous insights into humanity. John Henry Falk was born in Austin in 1913. His father was a progressive lawyer in the capital city and stood against Jim Crow. In the 1950s, John Henry became a national figure with a radio program, and he was a frequent guest on network television. But in 1957, during the anti-communist scare, Falk was blacklisted, most likely for his open support of civil rights, civil liberties, and labor. Other Hollywood and TV stars that shined even brighter than Falk at that time saw their careers destroyed by the blacklist. But with support from journalist Edward R. Murrow, Falk took the unheard-of step and challenged the blacklist in court. He won a libel suit against the corporation that branded him a communist, and he landed a significant blow against the regime of fear that had grabbed control of the nation at the time. In 1990, John Henry Falk died of cancer in his hometown of Austin. In 1974, Falk recorded a Texas Christmas story for the program Voices in the Wind.
The day after Christmas, a number of years ago, I was driving down a country road in Texas, and it was a bitter cold, cold morning. And walking ahead of me on the gravel road was a little barefooted boy with nondescript ragged overalls and a makeshift sleeve of a sweater tied around his little ears. I stopped and picked him up. Looked like he was about 12 years old, and his little feet were blue with the cold. He's carrying an orange, and he got in and had the brightest blue eyes one ever saw, and he turned a bright smile on my face and says, "I'm going down the road about 2 miles to my cousin's. I want to show him my orange old Sandy Claus brought me." Well, I wasn't going to mention Christmas to him because I figured he came from a family that kind of don't have Christmas. But he brought it up himself. He said, "Did old Santa Claus come to see you, mister?" And I said, "Yes, we had a real nice Christmas at our house, and I hope you had the same." He paused for a moment, looked at me, and then with all the sincerity in the world said, "Mister, we had the wonderfulest Christmas in the United States down to our place. Lordy, it was the first one we ever had there. See, we never do have them out there much. Don't notice when Christmas time comes. We'd heard about it, but never did have one because Well, you know, it just... Papa says that old Santa Claus, Papa Hoorah's lot, said old Santa Claus was scared to bring his reindeer down into our section of the county because folks down there are so hard up that they liable to catch one of his reindeer and butcher him for meat. But just several days before Christmas, a lady come out from town, and she told all the families through there, our family too, that there was old Santa Claus was coming to town to leave some things for us, and if Papa would go in town, he could get some Christmas time for all of us. And Papa hooked up the mule wagon. He went in town, but he told us children, said, now don't y'all get all worked up and excited because there might not be nothing to this yarn that lady told. And but shucks, he hadn't got out of sight up the lane there. We was done a watching for him to come back, and we couldn't get our minds on nothing else, you know. And Mama, she'd come door every once in a while and say, now y'all quit that looking up the lane because Papa told you there might not be nothing. And, but long about the middle of the afternoon, well, we heard the team of jangling the harness coming, and we ran out in the front yard, and Ernie, my little brother, called out, said, yonder come Papa, and here come them mules just in a big trot, you know, and Papa standing upright in the bed of that wagon holding two big old chickens, all feathers picked off, and he was just yelling, Merry Christmas, Merry Christmas, and the team stopped right in front of the gate, and all us children just went swarming out there like a flock of chee-chees, you know, and just crawling over that wagon and looking in. And, mister, I wish you could have seen what was in that wagon. It's bags of striped candy and apples and oranges and sacks of flour and some real coffee, you know, and just all tinsely and pretty, and we couldn't say nothing, just kind of held her breath and looked at it, you know, and Papa standing there just waving them two chickens and yelling, Merry Christmas to you, Merry Christmas to you, and a laughing, that big old grin on his face. And Mama, she come a-hurrying out with the baby in her arms, you know, and when she looked in that wagon, she just stopped, and Papa, he dropped them two chickens and retched and caught the baby out of her arms, you know, and held him up and said, Merry Christmas to you, Santa Claus, and baby little old Alvy Lee, he just laughed like he knowed it was Christmas too, you know. And Mama, she started telling us to name all of them nuts. They wasn't just peanuts. She had names for all of them. Mama knows a heap of things like that. She'd seen that stuff before, you know. And we's all of us just a chattering and a going on at the same time. Us young'uns are looking in there, and all of a sudden we heard Papa call out, "Merry Christmas to you, Sam Jackson." And we stopped and looked, and here comes Sam Jackson leading that old cripple leg mule of his up the lane. And Papa said, Sam Jackson, did you get in town to get some Christmas this year? Sam Jackson, you know, he sharecrops over there across the creek from our place. And he shook his head and said, well, no, sir, Mr. Will, I didn't go in town. I heard about that, but I didn't know it was for colored folks, too. I thought it was just for you white families. All of a sudden, none of us children were saying nothing. Papa, he looked down at Mama. And Mama looked up at him, and they didn't say nothing like they don't a heap of times, but they know what the others are thinking. They're like that, you know. And all of a sudden, Papa, he broke out in a big grin again. He said, Dad, blame it, Sam Jackson, it's sure a good thing you come by here. Lord have mercy, I like to forgot. Old Santa Claus would have me in court if he'd heard about this. The last thing he asked me if I lived out here near you. Said he hadn't seen you around and said he wanted me to bring part of this out here to you and your family, your woman and your children. Well, sir, Sam Jackson, he broke out in a big grin. And Papa said, I'll tell you what to do. You get your wife and children and you come down here tomorrow morning. It's going to be Christmas time all day long. Come early and stay late. And Sam Jackson said, you reckon? And Mama called out to him and said, yes, and you tell your wife to be sure and bring some pots and pans because we're going to have a heap of cooking to do, and I ain't sure I've got enough to take care of all of it. Well, sir, old Sam Jackson, he started off leading that mule up the lane in a full trot, you know, and he's heading home to get the word to his folks and his children, you know. And next morning, it just, you remember how it was yesterday morning? Just rosy red and looked like Christmas time. it's cold, but you didn't notice the cold, you know, and the sun just come up, just all rosy red. And us young'uns were all out of bed before daylight, seemed like, just running in the kitchen and smelling and looking. And it was all there, sure enough. And here comes Sam Jackson and his team and his wife and his five young'uns in there. And it's all looking over the edge, and we run out and yell, "Merry Christmas, Merry Christmas." And Papa said, "Christmas gift to you, Sam Jackson. Y'all come on in." And they come in, and Mama and Sister Jackson, they got in the kitchen, and they started cooking things up. And us young'uns started playing Christmas Time. And it's a lot of fun, you know. We just play Christmas gift with one another and run around and around the house and just roll in the dirt, you know. And then we started playing go up to the kitchen door and smell. And we'd run up and smell inside that kitchen door where Mom and Sister Jackson was cooking at. And then we'd just die laughing and roll in the dirt, you know, and go chasing around and playing Christmas gift. And we played Christmas Time till we just wore ourselves out. And Papa and Sam Jackson, they'd put a table up and put some sheets over it, some boards up over some sawhorses. And everybody had a place, even the baby. And Mom and Sister Jackson said, "Well, now it's ready. Come on in. We're going to have Christmas dinner." And I sit right next to Willie Jackson, you know, and he'd just roll his eyes at me, and I'd roll mine. We just die laughing, you know. And there was an apple and an orange and some stripedy candy at everybody's place. And that was just dessert. See, that wasn't a real Christmas dinner. Mom and them had done cooked that up, and they just had it spread up and down the table. And so Papa and Sam Jackson, they'd been sitting on the front porch, and they come in. Papa, he sit at one end of the table, and Sam Jackson sit at the other, and it was just a beautiful table like you never had seen. And I didn't know nothing could ever look like that and smell that good, you know. And Sam Jackson, you know, he's real black, and he had on that white clean shirt of his and in them overhauls. Everything had been washed and was real clean. Papa, he said, "Brother Jackson, I believe you're a deacon in the church. I ain't much of a church man myself, but I believe you're a deacon. Maybe you'd be willing to give grace." Well, Sam Jackson, he stood up there, and his hands was real big, and he kind of held on to the side of that table, you know. But he didn't bow his head like a heap of folks do when they're saying blessing. He just looked up and smiled. And he said, "Lord, I hope you having as nice a Christmas up there with your angels as we have it down here. Because it sure is Christmas time down here. And I just wanted to say Merry Christmas to you, Lord." Like I say, mister, I believe that was the wonderfulest Christmas in the United States of America.
That was John Henry Fox, A Texas Christmas Story, recorded in 1974 for Voices in the Wind.
I'll tell you the story of John Henry Falk. I'll tell you of his trials and the trouble trail he walked. And I'll tell you of the tyrants, the ones you never see. Murder is the role they play and hatred is their fee. On the TV and the radio, John Henry Falk was known. He talked to many thousands with a mind that was his own. But he could not close his eyes when the list were passed around, so he tried to move the union to tear the blacklist down. His friends, they tried to warn him he was heading for a fall. If he spoke against the blacklist, he had no chance at all. But he laughed away their warnings and he laughed away their fears, for how could lies destroy the work of many honest years?
A dozen years ago, I taught catechism classes at Our Lady of Sorrows Catholic Church. We called it Sorrows for short. I'd long been devoted to her, Nuestra Virgen de los Dolores, brandishing the seven swords that impale her exposed heart. This is a humble parish. The building where the classrooms were housed had no central air or heat. A thin film of dust covered everything. Breakfast was an inconsistent perk. Alguien se robó la leche, I heard more than once, about the gallon jugs of milk going missing. The coordinator told me that my lack of experience meant my charges would be the youngest kids. "Oh, I've been teaching a long time," I told her. "Not like this," she said, her eyes closed and her lips curling to a sad smile. "They're little devils. Les tienes que cortar la colita." I composed elaborate lesson plans, timing each activity and factoring the snack and bathroom breaks that would ensure our time together at the 10 o'clock Mass to be free of rumbling stomachs or fidgeting feet. Every single class required erratic course correction. I got used to anticipating everything going wrong. Students walked in late, bedheaded and sleepy and hungry. In the winter, we didn't remove or even unbutton our coats because the rooms were so cold. The children had mal aliento and moquitos. "Please go blow your nose," I implored Maria, the tiniest girl. "No sé cómo," she said, and my job description changed again. Esme wore thick glasses. She wanted to sit in my lap. She drew pictures of us together and wrote, "I love you," all over sticky sheets of theme paper. She tried to sit next to me during Mass, causing drama when she pinched or shoved kids out of the way to get to me. After a few weeks, I gave up lesson planning. We could wheel in an ancient television and watch videos about the cruel lives of saints. At Christmas time, we watched one about Juan Diego and the Virgen de Guadalupe. Warped and with fading color and sound, it failed to keep the attention of the children who colored pictures of Jesus and his disciples, looking a lot like Marco Antonio Solís and his bookies. One day, a boy with a buzz cut and big white chiclet teeth appeared at the door with his mother. Like many of the mothers, she did not speak English. She was short and slight like a child herself, with tight bejeweled jeans and a too small fleece jacket. "Carlos ya se tomó su medicina," she said, walking away. I took his cold, dry hand. Carlos was nonverbal and antisocial. He grew restless when we moved to an actual lesson, an impromptu discussion of the day's scriptures. He'd run down the hall, and I'd find him in the boys' room, where he played with the soap dispenser or turned up the faucet as far as it would go. Over several weeks, his behavior grew more unpredictable. He took crayons from the other kids or ripped their artwork. The boys followed his lead, running out of the room or fighting. The girls huddled together, screaming and laughing at the loud pelea. I asked the coordinator if Carlos could sit with his mom during the Mass. "His mom doesn't come to the Mass," she said. "Have you ever seen her? Sorry, this isn't college. Just take care of them." Catechism became a bad babysitting gig, a godless place, and Mass was worse. I hardly heard a word of the service as I tried to keep Carlos focused on some toy I snuck in, knowing that his boredom would bring about his uncontrollable behavior. He would kick the pew in front of him or pinch or punch the other kids. One Sunday, he kicked me many times, dug his heel into the top of my foot, and bit my arm. I dragged him to the back of the church. We dodged and parried back there, an arm wrestle neither of us won. A woman sitting in the last pew watched us for a moment. Her look of disdain was for me. After Mass, I held Carlos by the wrist to keep him from running into the street. He yanked hard until fatigue calmed him, and then he took my hand, and we waited together. When his mother showed up an hour later, her eyes looked dilated, glassy. She said her ride was late. "Can you come to the Mass the next time then?" I asked her. "No, no puedo," she said. "Pues yo no puedo tampoco," I snapped. I told her that Carlos had misbehaved and I wasn't able to stop his disruptions in class or in Mass. "Oh, no," she said, nodding, her eyes narrowing. "¿Y tú eres mamá?" she asked. "Sí," I said it defiantly. "Mamá," the word always feels too big for me, too big, too good for me. But just "sí" or "yes" is easy and has its own inherent power, even if there's too little to back it up, and it feels like saying "thanks be to God" after a reading you really didn't listen to. Carlos ran to his mother as if he'd been lost and finally found her. She kissed the top of his head, misjudging the strength of her movement, and hit her mouth hard. She touched her index finger to her front teeth and looked at her open palm. My tote bag of books and supplies, juice boxes, and crayons weighed heavy. I wanted to leave it all right there and never see sorrows again, or feel the stab of her seven blades, or love a boy as if he were my own son.
We'll be swinging around the Christmas tree, dancing to a Christmas melody. When it's Christmas time in Texas,
be snow in San Antonio, but it's a Texas Christmas to me. When Santa crosses over the border, he'll sound a little different when he sings. He'll hear those twin fiddles playing Christmas songs with a touch of western swing.
Making tamales isn't for the faint of heart. The process is long, strenuous, and complicated. The recipe isn't written down, but is part of an oral tradition tracing back to the Mayans and the Aztecs cooking up tamales for soldiers and travelers. No, there's no one recipe to look up in a cookbook or the internet. The wisdom of the abuelitas handed down for generations and the experience of making them is the golden key to a good tamalada. Here are 9 things to know about making tamales. Number 1, make the commitment. You can't wimp into a tamalada. Someone sets the date, duties are assigned, indecision is vanquished. The annual Christmas tamalada is on. Number 2, everything but everything is from scratch. You won't be able to cheat with bottled ground cumin and pre-chopped garlic. Get out that molcajete. Be prepared to use lard for the first time since the last time you made tamales. 3, only one person is allowed to masar la masa. A second pair of hands will taint the masa and ruin everyone's Christmas. In the event that the main masa mom is not able to fulfill her masando duties, you'll have to step up. Number 4, the water test must be performed. This is akin to the wall test for spaghetti, although the tamal test is different. When you think it's ready, put a dollop of masa in a glass of room temperature water. If it floats, it's ready. If it doesn't float, it's not ready. Don't proceed until it floats, or you will single-handedly ruin everyone's Christmas and their New Year. Number 5, select your spoon. For the rest of the day, you will become one with the spoon spreading masa. If your spoon gets mixed up with someone else's, you will know it as soon as you pick it up. It will feel different. You can tell. Number 6, everyone has one job in tamale making, but be prepared to pinch hit. You might have to be in charge of soaking the corn husks, spreading the masa, or filling the tamales with meat or beans. Just don't stick your hands in the masa unless you are the one. 7, do a taste test with the first dozen tamales. This is the one and only lull in the frenetic pace of the assembly line. You'll already feel tired and question your sanity for agreeing to another Christmas tamalada. But when you taste that first tamal, it will be like Popeye spinach. You will be imbued with the strength to go on for 10 more hours of tamalada. 8, in tamale making, there are sitters and standers. The back of your neck's going to hurt. Your feet will hurt, your legs, even your butt, if you're a sitter. Feel the burn. This is for tamales. It's worth it. 9, be present. It's easy to zone out while spreading masa on hoja after hoja, but resist falling into that inner space of your mind. Join in the conversation, the chisme, the singing, the laughter, and the tears. At no other time except for weddings and funerals will this same group of loved ones convene. Every time you open the freezer for anything else, for ice cubes or ice cream or frozen veggies, you'll see the bags of tamales there piled high, and you'll feel a nameless emotion that makes your heart ache a little, and remember the day and all the other December days you've spent together making tamales. That's it for this edition of Texas Matters. Thanks for listening. I'm Yvette Benavides. Texas Matters is co-produced by David Martin Davies. You can download Texas Matters from iTunes and check out past programs on our website at tpr.org. And tune in again next week for another edition of Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio.